Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's March 6th, Thursday. Let's look at the schedule. All right, you guys. Somebody might be interested in the schedule because that's when we give a test according to the schedule. So, next test is on the 25th, right? And so that's 2.5 weeks from today. 25th is on a Tuesday. And what's going to be on that test? 4, 5, and 7. We're done with 4. We'll be done with 5 today. And then we have a couple lectures on nervous system. That's a really long chapter. If you want to read ahead, that would be a good idea. Okay. So 4, 5, and 7 on the next exam. So let's just go right into lecture. Unless somebody's got a question. Anybody have a question over what we talked about last time? Or the schedule? You guys are good? All right, so yeah, we're doing some more chemistry, some biochemistry. So what do I have on the screen right now? What do I have on the screen right now? Yeah, glycolysis, and it's a graph of free energy versus the stage of that metabolic pathway. And that first stage, glucose going through here, is that exorganic or endorganic? Yeah, you got to know. Well, I see ATP being used up. So that means that glucose going up to over here is endorganic. It needs energy. And as a matter of fact, take a look at this arrow right here. Right, you can see the glucose is at a lower energy level than this metabolite right here. Right, so that's how you can tell this is an endorganic reaction. Endorganic when the products have more energy compared to the reactants. All right. And endorganic reactions usually use ATP as an energy source in our bodies. Another way of thinking of that is maybe using a gradient of something, an ion gradient of sodium or electrons or something like that. All right, what about this second part of glycolysis? Is it exorganic or endorganic? It's exorganic, that's right. And so energy is being released. Right, and so from this reaction, right, the energy that's being released is the energy from pyruvic acid to glucose. Not this activation energy, because you put activation energy in and then you get activation energy back out. So that really doesn't change the equation for the change in energy in this metabolic pathway. It's only from the initial substrate down to the product. And we can ignore this right here. All right, so what does your body like to do with exorganic reactions? They kind of mention that in the chapter, right? Because this is an exorganic reaction going all the way down to pyruvate. What is something your body likes to do with exorganic reactions? It likes to make, look what we got right here. It likes to make ATP out of exorganic reactions. All right, so energy is being released, and as a result from glycolysis, two ATPs, a net two ATPs is being produced. Right, so here are two ATPs, here are two, they cancel out, so we're left with two ATPs being made by glycolysis. All right, so that should strike you as not very many ATPs, because you need so many just to stay alive. I think we talked about when you can't make ATP in the brain, for instance, when the heart stops beating, how many seconds of consciousness do you have before you run out of too much ATP? About 2 to 3 seconds, right? And then when does your brain die because there's no ATP? 2 to 3 minutes, right? So it's a pretty fast process, right? And don't forget NADH. This is a high energy form of NAD+. So just like ADP going to ATP, this is an endorganic reaction, but it's coupled to that exorganic reaction of glycolysis. Okay, so that's, I think, maybe that's all I'm going to say about glycolysis right now. All right, we talked about lactic acid. We learned about glycogenesis and glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis. Lipogenesis is making lipids, and lipolysis is breaking them down. So let's take a look at that lipolysis a little bit. So it's going to break down triglycerides, And can you remember what the building blocks of triglycerides are? It's glycerol and three fatty acids. All right, so lipolysis is the breaking down of a glyceride. It's not the breaking down of a fatty acid. Lipolysis produces fatty acids. We're going to look at another metabolic pathway then that can metabolize fatty acids. And we're going to see that that's called beta oxidation. That's one of the last things we're going to look at. Okay, so we talked about this slide last time. And we labeled some of these processes, like glucose going all the way down to pyruvate. You're going to call that glycolysis, right? And if you have glucose going into glycogen, what do we call that? Glucose to glycogen. Glycogenesis. Okay, and then of course cells regulate this process, and then you can break glycogen down to get glucose back. And what do we call that process? Glycogen going to glucose. Glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis, the lysis of glycogen. What kind of metabolic reaction would be used for this to happen? A hydrolysis reaction, right? Hydrolysis reaction. All right. Now, that takes it to the Cori cycle. And I don't think your textbook has all of these numbers listed. And I do want you to be familiar with what all these things are called. And we just said, what do we call glucose going to glycogen in this skeletal muscle cell? Glucose going to glycogen. What is this? Okay, so in a resting cell, this is going to predominate. Glucose to glycogen. It's got to be on the tip of your tongue, okay, by probably next week. That's glycogenesis, making glycogen. All right, but when the cell starts to exercise, cell needs glucose, so it's going to break glycogen down. What's the building block of glycogen? Glucose. All right, so glycogen is broken down to glucose when the cell is exercising. And what's the name of this process? It's not exercise. It just happens during exercise. That is the lysis of glycogen or glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis, the breakdown of glycogen. All right, so now since the cell is exercising, this glucose then gets converted into pyruvic acid. But how many pyruvic acids? Yeah, because glucose is snipped in half. So you end up with two pyruvic acids. You could put that down on the slide, but what's more important, I want to know what the name of this conversion is from glucose to these two pyruvates. What's that? Yeah, that's glycolysis. And you know what's being produced by glycolysis. Okay, and if there's not much oxygen in these cells, like when a muscle is contracted, blood can't get into it, and then those muscle cells don't have oxygen, then the cell has to figure out what to do with this pyruvic acid. And what it does, it converts it into lactic acid. Lactic acid leaves the cell. Pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, so it's stopped. It's trapped inside the cell. Lactic acid moves into the blood, and let's leave it there for a second. So what do we call this process of converting pyruvate to lactate? And probably I would like for you just to label this the LDH reaction, right? Lactate dehydrogenase reaction. And remember, the energy of pyruvic acid is the same as lactic acid, and lactic acid can be converted to pyruvic acid. Pyruvic acid can be converted into lactic acid. Either way, it doesn't really matter. But which way is it going to, which direction is going to predominate? Which one is, and how would you understand, which way is this arrow going to go? As a matter of fact, why don't you draw two heads on this arrow right here? Which way is this reaction going to go? And based on a principle, a chemistry principle, that is Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. As pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, then the cell is going to convert that to lactic acid. And then when lactic acid leaves, then the cell is going to convert more pyruvic acid to lactic acid to regenerate the concentration of lactic acid. All right, the other thing that's happening is that when pyruvate is converted into lactic acid, remember, NADH is generated, and that's NAD is generated, NAD plus is necessary for glycolysis. It's a substrate for glycolysis. All right, so lactate now is in the blood, goes to the liver. The liver soaks it up, and it takes this lactic acid and converts it into pyruvate. And what's the name that I would like for you to have right here? LDH, right? It's the same one as over here. Lactate dehydrogenase. And remember, this reaction can go one way or the other. It's a bidirectional, because the energy between pyruvate and lactate is basically the same. And then what is this reaction? Number 6, pyruvic acid going to glucose. What do we call that? Gluconeogenesis. Yeah, gluconeogenesis. It's the reverse of glycolysis. And then depending on the metabolic state of the cell or the body, that glucose can be put into glycogen. And how would you label this arrow here? Going from glucose to glycogen. Glycogenesis, right? And when the liver wants to build up levels of glucose, what do we call glycogen going to glucose? Glycogenolysis. Yeah, so practice saying those things. All right, so the liver cell now has glucose-6-phosphate in it, and it wants to ship it back out to a muscle, which uses it as an energy source when it goes through glycolysis. And the liver does have a special enzyme that can take this phosphate off of glucose. And remember, that phosphate group has a lot of ionic character to it, has a lot of negative charges on it, so those negative charges can't get through the cell membrane. But when an enzyme takes that phosphate off, it loses all those electrical charges, and then glucose can leave a liver cell. And it goes into the blood, and once it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere where the blood goes, right? And it can leave a capillary in a muscle, and this muscle can take it up. And one of the first things this muscle does is what? Converts it from glucose to glucose-6-phosphate. And now that glucose in this muscle cell, right, has been trapped. And a muscle cell can't dephosphorylate glucose. So once glucose gets into this muscle cell, it's there forever until it's used up, unlike this nice altruistic cell from the liver. All right, so let's think of glucose-6-phosphate going to glucose. What kind of enzyme would be used right here for number 7? What kind of enzyme takes phosphate off of glucose? That would be, you kind of know where that is in your notes. That's called a phosphatase, just generally. And sometimes we incorporate the name of the substrate, so you could say glucose-6-phosphatase produces glucose, right? And then 8 and 4 down over here is just transport of glucose in the blood. There's no particular chemical reaction. And then glucose enters this muscle cell, gets converted from glucose to glucose-6-phosphate. What kind of enzyme will phosphorylate glucose when it gets inside the cell? A kinase, yeah. So phosphatases and kinase have opposite actions. All right, and then that glucose can go through glycolysis again. And what are some energy molecules that are produced by glycolysis? What are some energy molecules? All right, so remember, glycolysis, at least part of this last phase of glycolysis, is exorganic. And what your body likes to do with exorganic reactions is make ATP. Okay, so that muscle cell now gets a couple ATP and by producing pyruvic acid. Okay, and this process can go over and over and over and over again, even though this pyruvic acid can't enter the mitochondria. So let's go back to this very first slide that we were looking at. I passed it by right here. Okay, when is it possible for pyruvic acid to enter a mitochondria? Oxygen has to be present, right? That's under aerobic conditions. So we just looked at some anaerobic conditions where pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid. And so we're going to look at aerobic respiration really, really soon after I make just another point. All right, and this is a good place to look. All right, so remember, you take glucose and you snip it in half, you get two pyruvate molecules. And we see that glucose is phosphorylated, so it gains a phosphate. Then in the second step, it gets another phosphate. So how many phosphates are on this sugar molecule after two ATPs are used up? So this is no longer glucose because there's been a little bit of a rearrangement. This is fructose, 1,6, right? These are the positions on this monosaccharide where the phosphates are. And is this a monophosphate or a biphosphate or a triphosphate? That's a biphosphate, right? So there are now two phosphates on this fructose. Then fructose is split in half, and each half gets a phosphate. And then the next reaction that produces NADH, look at this inorganic phosphate group, joins this one that has one phosphate. And what are we back to here? This intermediate has how many phosphates on it now? It's got two. And it also has a lot of energy. And as it proceeds to pyruvic acid, guess what it can do with those phosphates? It can donate them to ADP, making ATP out of them. All right, so here is number 6 is an exorganic reaction in glycolysis. That energy can be used to make ATP. All right, so if this molecule loses a phosphate after this reaction, how many does it have? Okay, so here we have 2. It loses 1, and you end up with 1. Right, that 3 is just the position in the molecule. It's not that it has 3 phosphates. Right? It just has 1. And then a couple little rearrangements. And what can be done with that 1 phosphate that's on this intermediate? It can be donated to ADP to make ATP out of it. All right, so that's how these phosphates get added to ADP to make ATP. This kind of process of making ATP just by using enzymes and interconverting intermediates, we call this substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so you probably want to jot that down on glycolysis. Right? Substrate level phosphorylation as compared to another kind of phosphorylation step that we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, so we've made pyruvic acid at the end of glycolysis. And under aerobic conditions, right, it can enter a mitochondria. And when it enters the mitochondria, it goes into a preparatory reaction. And I probably would like to go back to that beginning slide. But initial slide, can you see where it's shaded to be mitochondria? Let me just flip back really quick. Right here. All right, so here is pyruvic acid entering the mitochondria. This arrow is what we call a preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. And we're going to look at that one right now. After the preparatory reaction, then the Krebs cycle takes place. And then lastly, we're going to talk about electron transport. So we're talking about this step right here. Right? And what's necessary for pyruvic acid to go into the mitochondria? Oxygen. It happens only under aerobic conditions. Here is the reaction. How many carbons does pyruvic acid have? It's got 3, right? Because we started with glucose, which is 6, snipped in half. You got pyruvic acid. Okay. Well, what's going to happen here is that it's going to be decarboxylated. So this carbon-carbon bond is going to be broken. And when that carbon-carbon bond is broken, what's released? There's energy in this chemical bond. And when it's broken, it's released. Right? So going from pyruvic acid over to here is an exorganic reaction. So we got to take into account that decarboxylation, and it produces what? CO2. So pyruvic acid, when it's converted into acetyl coenzyme A, a carbon dioxide is produced. So a really good question would be, what organelle inside your cells produces CO2 that you have to breathe out of your body? So where are we right now? We're inside a mitochondria, right? So mitochondria produce all of that CO2. All right, so now, after one decarboxylation, how many carbons are left? And you can see it right here. We have 2. Anytime you see acetyl, an acetyl group is always going to be a 2-carbon molecule someplace. Right. And we have coenzyme A, so that acetyl group is bound to coenzyme A. And what do you know about a coenzyme? Tell me something about a coenzyme. Are they big organic compounds or little metal ions? What the heck are these things? Big organic compounds that do what? Carry an intermediate from one set of reactions to another. So this is a really perfect example of a coenzyme. because it's carrying this acetyl group from glycolysis into the Krebs cycle. All right, so that's coenzyme A. Here's coenzyme A, nice sulfhydryl group that can bind an acetyl group very nicely. And then NAD plus also gets reduced into NAD. And can you remember what NAD is carrying? NAD plus is converted into NADH. What is NADH carrying? High energy electrons, right? So the NADH has a lot of energy that maybe a cell can use to make ATP out of. We're going to see how that goes in just a second. All right, so don't forget, NAD plus is the oxidized form. NADH is the reduced form because it accepts electrons during this reaction. All right, so now we got acetyl-CoA. Remember, it has two carbons because one has been taken off, turned into carbon dioxide. And so here is the preparatory reaction, kind of a nice illustration. Right, so pyruvic acid entered the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. And here is the first step of the Krebs cycle. Sometimes we call this the citric acid cycle because that's one of the compounds that is produced. All right, so an acetyl group has two carbons. It fuses with oxaloacetate, which has four carbons. So citric acid has to have how many? It's just 4 plus 2. So citric acid has six carbons, and then it goes around in this cycle right here through a bunch of chemical reactions. We're going to look at just some of the details of this, but when it goes through the Krebs cycle, on this illustration, what do you see being produced? CO2. And where is it being produced once again? Where is that CO2 being produced? In mitochondria, right? So all three, right? Because pyruvic has three carbons, so 1, 2, 3. There are these three decarboxylations which produce carbon dioxide, which of course we have to breathe out of our body. All right, so the Krebs cycle produces one GTP, and the energy level of GTP and ATP is basically the same. They can interconvert. So when you see the production of one GTP, you can also consider that the production of an ATP because these reactions can go back and forth. It produces three NADHs. And what's in this NADH? High energy electrons. And it produces one FADH2. And like NADH, FADH2 is carrying high energy electrons. Okay. And they're going to carry those electrons to the electron transport chain, or what we call just ETC. We're going to have a couple illustrations of that. Okay, here's the Krebs cycle. Is this an exam figure? It's not an exam figure. Oh, you guys, makes me worried that you haven't printed out your exam figures yet. This is not an exam figure, right? But I do want you to know some things about it. So here's that acetyl group, right? And it binds with oxaloacetic acid, which has four carbons. So citric acid has six carbons, right? And then it starts to go through these decarboxylation steps. There's a little bit of a rearrangement, and there's a decarboxylation step because here you can see a CO2 being produced. And just like in the preparatory reaction, NAD plus can be reduced into NADH as the Krebs cycle is turning in this clockwise direction. And is NADH, is that a great molecule to have? And why? High energy electrons, that's right. So this thing, NADH, can release those electrons, and that's an exorganic reaction. And what does your body like to do with exorganic reactions? Make ATP out of it. Okay. So here's one NADH that's being produced. Here's another decarboxylation step, and another NADH is being produced. So far we got two NADHs and 1, 2 carbon dioxides. Remember the preparatory reaction, we lost the carbon. All right, so now all of the carbons that were in that pyruvate get converted into CO2 in what organelle? It's not on this slide, in mitochondria, produce all that CO. Every time we exhale, all that CO2 came from mitochondria. All right, so now we still have some high-energy intermediates, and this step between alpha-ketoglutaric acid and succinic acid, there's enough energy, this is exorganic enough to actually phosphorylate GDP into GTP. Right? And remember, GTP can be converted into ATP very easily because the energy levels are the same. So this step right here looks very much like how ATP is produced by glycolysis. And what did we call the production of ATP in glycolysis? We called it substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so here is another place where substrate level phosphorylation happens. All right, but remember, the Krebs cycle only works under what kind of conditions? Aerobic conditions. All right, so just because it's substrate level, it doesn't mean it's anaerobic or aerobic conditions. All right, and then this proceeds again, a couple more rearrangements, no more decarboxylations, but there's still some energy in these molecules, and another NAD plus is converted into NADH. So when you look at the Krebs cycle, right, you should, your take-home message is, what's being produced by the Krebs cycle? Okay, two acetyl-CoAs go in, right, because there are two of them for every glucose. Right, so one turn of the Krebs cycle produces what? One, two, three NADHs. How many ATPs? One. And also one FADH, carrying high energy electrons. So three NADHs, one FADH2, and one ATP from the Krebs cycle. All right, so that's great. We got one more ATP. Well, remember, Krebs cycle turns twice for every glucose, so we actually get two ATP. How many did we get out of glycolysis? Two, right. All right, so now we got four. We doubled the amount, but that's still not very much. That's not enough to keep most cells in our body alive. So where do we get the rest of our ATP? All right, we get the rest of our ATP through a process called oxidative phosphorylation using these electrons that are in NADH and FADH2. And NADH, FADH2, high energy electrons, they like to flow through various molecules or chemicals to lose energy, and that would be an exergonic reaction, and that produces ATP. So here is the electron transport chain, and it is what? Pretty much like the graphs that we've been looking at for the last couple days. It's a graph of energy versus the progress of some metabolic pathway. And this metabolic pathway is what we call the electron transport chain. And so we're going to notice that what moves through all these different molecules, right, are electrons. So this thing almost, you could almost think of this thing as like being a wire because electrons are just passing through it. All right, so the two molecules that we have high energy electrons in are NADH and FADH2. And can you tell me, which has more energy? Which high energy electrons have more energy? Is it the electrons in NADH or the electrons in FADH2? And how on earth would you know that? How on earth would you know? Because here, that graph is the answer key. You just have to know how to read it. Because this is a plot of energy, and as you go up this vertical axis, what can you tell me about energy? Okay, it's increasing. It's increasing. Energy is increasing. Less energy where I have the cursor now, more where I have the cursor now. And from here to here, more energy. From here to here, even more energy. All right, so which one has a higher energy, NADH or FADH2? NADH, okay, as illustrated on this diagram. All right, and then as these electrons flow through these various chemicals, is that an exergonic or endergonic reaction? Remember that last part of glycolysis looked just like that, and that's an exergonic set of metabolic pathway. All right, so here is another exergonic reaction, these electrons flowing through all these various chemicals. And so what can your body do with an exergonic reaction? Make ATP out of it. And in particular, we're going to say that electron transport for every NADH produces how many ATP? I see three on this illustration. And that's really what I want for you to remember. Every NADH produces three ATP. All right, now where do these electrons end up? Right, if they don't have any place to go, then that's going to stop the electron transport chain, because every time an electron is donated, okay, then the next step, has this an oxidized form has to be reduced, And then in the next step, an oxidized form has to be reduced, on and on and on and on down the line. And if cytochrome A, which is the very last step over here, if it stays in the reduced form, it can't accept any more electrons, right? Because it has accepted some electrons to become reduced. If it stays in that reduced state, then that stops the electron transport chain. Those electrons have to find a place to go. And where do they go? They are combined with water and some hydrogen ions, and it produces water. That's the very last step of the electron transport chain. It produces water. And if there's no oxygen present, water can't be produced. Those electrons get trapped in the electron transport chain. And if the electron transport chain is not working, what else is not being made? Okay, water's not being made. But what are we really concerned with here? ATP. ATP is not being made either. Right. So these electrons have to go someplace, and they go into oxygen. They go into molecular oxygen. All right, so what can you tell me about inspiration? Why do we inhale? Okay, we exhale to get rid of those carbon dioxides, right, from Krebs cycle and the preparatory reaction, but why do we inhale? Okay, just so that there's some air in our lungs so that we can put carbon dioxide in it? No. Okay, we inhale because we need that oxygen, which is in the air, right? So we inhale for oxygen, and when we inhale oxygen, guess what? Electron transport chain can operate, and ATP can be made as a result of that. All right, so we need that oxygen in order to make all these ATP from electron transport chain. All right, so some of these things you probably noticed, they're advertised on TV, like coenzyme Q. You can buy these things in health stores, and some people think that maybe it gives them more energy, but you'd have to have a really deficient diet not to have all these things in the proper amounts in just a regular diet. So it's probably not too useful to take vitamin supplements of these various intermediates of the electron transport chain. All right, but just remember, when NADH, all right, here's NADH, that's a reduced form. When it gives away those electrons, it becomes oxidized. NAD plus is the oxidized form. And what can you tell me about, and this is an oxidation reaction, what can you tell me about an oxidation reaction? What else has to happen? A reduction reaction has to happen. They go hand in hand, right? So here is a compound, FMN. You don't have to know what that stands for. It accepts those electrons, and when it does, what can you tell me about FMNH2? Okay, if NAD plus is the oxidized form, what about FMNH2? That's the reduced form, right? Oxidation and reduction reactions are always coupled to each other. All right, so here's coenzyme Q. In an oxidized form, it can receive electrons from the step right above it and become reduced. And these electrons then flow through all these intermediates, losing energy. All right. Well, you told me that NADH has a higher energy level than FADH2. It shows it right on this graph, which means that FADH2 can't donate electrons to FMN because it doesn't have the right energy level. It donates it over here to coenzyme Q. And when it does that, it's missing a step. It's bypassing a step. What step is it missing? This first step of ATP production. So FADH2 can produce how many ATPs? Only two. NADH can produce three. So the electrons are not exactly equal in terms of energy. NADH has more energy than FADH2. And we can see why that happens with the electron transport chain. Okay, and where do we find this thing? Where is this electron transport chain located? Where did we end up? Yeah, mitochondria, right? Because that's where the Krebs cycle was, and that's where all those NADHs are being produced in the Krebs cycle. So this is in the matrix, that's that inner space within a mitochondria. And all of these molecules are not floating around in solution, they're attached to that inner membrane. So these intermediates are part of that inner membrane, and that's why it has a special name. What do we call that inner membrane of a mitochondria? Yeah, the Christie membrane, right? That, ooh, you got to go all the way back to anatomy to remember that. Okay. All right, so NADH, FADH2 do carry electrons to electron transport, and then they're shuttled in sequence through that chain of molecules. NAD plus is regenerated, FAD is regenerated, so that the Krebs cycle can continue to work, because these are necessary for the Krebs cycle to turn, right? These are substrates for the Krebs cycle. Okay, that's important to know. Okay, so this kind of phosphorylation is not what we call substrate-level phosphorylation, right? Because it's in the Christi membrane, and we're going to take a look and see why it is super special. But one reason that you can see that this is not substrate-level phosphorylation is because, right, here we need oxygen to accept those electrons. So these three ATPs that are being made from electrons in NADH is what we call oxidative phosphorylation, not substrate-level. Right. What about these two ATPs right here that are being made from electrons in FADH2? Is this substrate level phosphorylation or oxidative phosphorylation? And it's the same? Okay, only two are made. So this is oxidative phosphorylation once again. So any kind of ATP that's made by electron transport chain is made by oxidative phosphorylation. And that will just help you remember that oxygen is necessary for this metabolic pathway to operate. Right. Okay, so there is just that really nice same kind of plot of energy versus the metabolic pathway. Okay, well, let's get back to looking at something that's a little bit more concrete. So here we have a really nice illustration. Some artist drew this up. And this is of the membranes that we see inside a mitochondria. And we're zoomed way in, right? We're just looking at a little piece of the membranes that make up a mitochondria. Here is the outer membrane. And can you remember, can you see that this kind of looks like a membrane? What's it made out of? Yeah, phospholipids, right? Oh, and it goes on and on and on and on and on, right? This is the outer membrane of a mitochondria. But a mitochondria also has the Christi membrane. Okay, which I see right here. Here's the Christi membrane. And remember, cells can put all kinds of interesting things in membranes, proteins and things like that. And the mitochondria puts these proteins into the Christi membrane. And some of these proteins are involved with the electron transport chain. So here's NADH. And where do we have this NADH? Is it in the cytoplasm? Or is it in that very inner space of a mitochondria, which we call the matrix? Or is this the space between the two membranes in a mitochondria? Yeah, it's in the matrix. This is the most innermost space. All right. And then, once you go past the Christi membranes, more superficially is the intermembrane space. And then if you go through the outer membrane, then you're in the cytoplasm of the cell. Okay. So we have NADH in the cell. We also have FADH2. But let's just consider NADH first. And NADH is produced by Krebs cycle. That would be a really good place for you to know. And it can donate electrons, donates it to this first protein in the membrane. And as this electron loses energy and moves into the second step, the second molecule of electron transport, it gives up energy to this protein. And when that happens, it can take hydrogen ions that are in the matrix and put them into the intermembrane space. And it can do that even though there's a high concentration of protons in this intermembrane space. This protein can go from low concentration to high concentration. So is diffusion going from low concentration to high concentration? Is that diffusion? No, it's the opposite. Remember, diffusion just happens automatically. But something from low concentration to high requires energy, right, in order to go to a higher, more concentrated space. And that energy comes from these electrons in NADH. All right, so then these electrons flow into another protein. And as they flow into cytochrome C, that moves more protons up into this intermembrane space, which means what? Now there's even a higher concentration of hydrogen ions in the intermembrane space, right? And lesser right here inside the matrix. Well, what did you know, what did you learn about a gradient, say, of ions, or a gradient of salt? How should you really think of a gradient of something that's separated by a membrane? It is an energy source. It's a source of energy, right? Just like in your batteries that you have in your cell phones, there's a gradient of electrical charge from one terminal to another, and you can power electronic devices with it. All right, now how does a mitochondria use that energy in the gradient? Well, we're going to see that in just a second. Because NADH produces how many ATPs when it's in the mitochondria? 1, 2, 3. Okay, so you could kind of just visualize it with these proteins that are right here. The electrons flow into this very last pump, and this very last pump then can take those high-energy electrons, combine it with molecular oxygen with some protons down over here, and it makes water as a result of that. All right, so now all the electrons are in their ground state, but every time it has moved, right, it has pumped protons into this inner membrane space. So here you have a high concentration of protons. In the matrix, you have a low concentration of protons. So what do these protons like to do if we were to just let them go and go wherever they wanted to go? Where would they go? From high concentration to low concentration. And where do we have high concentration with respect to where I have the cursor? Yeah, it's just right there. There's a high concentration of protons in that intermembrane space. There is a low concentration in the matrix, so these protons are just dying to get back down through their concentration gradient. There's energy in that. And here is a special protein that allows that to happen. And it's called ATP synthetase or ATP synthase. It's the same thing. It's a channel. Here I see a channel, and this proton can move down this gradient. And as it does, it releases energy so that ATP combine or ADP combines with inorganic phosphate to make ATP. All right. So ATP synthase goes across the membrane, and that gradient has energy. This protein here can undergo oxidative phosphorylation. This is not substrate level phosphorylation, but this is oxidative phosphorylation. Okay. So for every NADH, this system is going to make 3 ATPs. That's how I would like for you to know. So this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory. Right, those high-energy electrons create a gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. When they flow back across the Christi membrane through this ATP synthetase, that produces ATP. All right, so this is by far the majority of how ATP is made in your body. And so what's necessary? In order for electron transport chain to operate, you need oxygen because it's the final electron acceptor. And when it accepts those electrons, it gets converted into water when it combines with some hydrogen ions. Okay, and then those electrons have to be given away, otherwise electron transport chain is going to stop. Okay, so let's look at ATP formation. Substrate level, sometimes we call that direct level or direct phosphorylation. I like substrate level phosphorylation much more. That's kind of what I grew up with. All right. And that is just ATP that's being produced by some enzymatic reactions. Not that really fancy one that we just looked at. Not that chemiosmotic production or oxidative phosphorylation. So where is substrate level ATP produced? We looked at that already. In glycolysis, okay? Glycolysis, and glycolysis makes how many ATP? 2, yeah, makes 2. So both ATPs in glycolysis are made that way. All right, and what's another? Where's another place where ATP is made by substrate level phosphorylation? And that was in the Krebs cycle when GTP was made, and GTP then is interconverted into ATP. And remember, for every glucose, how many times does the Krebs cycle go around? It goes around twice, right? Because it starts with pyruvic acid, which has 3 carbons, and glucose has 6. Right? So Krebs cycle goes around twice. That's why we see 2 ATPs for every glucose in the Krebs cycle. All right, what about oxidative phosphorylation? Well, let's see. The Krebs cycle produces how many NADHs? One turn produces 3. But remember, for every glucose, it goes around twice, so there's 6. And so there's 6, And so how many ATPs can be made by one NADH? It's 3, so what's 3 times 6? That's 18 just with that. All right, so that's a lot more ATP than this measly 2 from glycolysis. Do you see sort of what's happening right there? Okay, but that's not all. What else do we want to consider? FADH2. How many ATPs can be produced by FADH2? 2, right? And so Krebs cycle goes around twice. And so that FADH can produce another 4 ATPs going through electron transport chain. All right, so that's why I would really like for you in your mind to have a nice snapshot of, okay, this right here. I want you to be able to remember Krebs cycle produces 3 NADHs and 1 FADH2. So 3 ATPs from this one, 3 from this one, 3 from this one, and 2 from here. All right, so 3 times 3 is 9, but remember this turns around twice, so 18 ATPs. From that, and then an additional 4 from NADH2. And if we add all of those ATPs up, we see that oxidative phosphorylation produces 30-something ATPs for every glucose. Substrate level only produces 2 from glycolysis, 2 from Krebs cycle, so 4. So what produces more ATP? Direct substrate level phosphorylation or oxidative phosphorylation? And is it a big difference or just a little difference? More, yeah, it's almost 10 times as many, right? So there's a big difference. So oxidative phosphorylation is used in our body to produce a lot of ATP. Okay, so sometimes your book talks about those protons that move from one place to another, but I just lectured not on proteins, protons moving through the ETC. How would I like for you to think about those electrons, right? So I wouldn't pay too much attention to these protons. All right, so so that's, I think, something that I want you to remember. 3 ATP for every NADH, 2 for every FADH2. Okay, and you can add that up together. And then if we add that to what we get from glycolysis and direct level phosphorylation in Krebs, that's 30-something ATPs under aerobic conditions versus how many under anaerobic conditions? How many under anaerobic conditions? Okay, under anaerobic conditions, that means just glycolysis. And how many are made by glycolysis? Yeah, just two. So that's a comparison between aerobic respiration and anaerobic respiration. I'm not so concerned that you know if aerobic respiration produces 30 ATP or 31 or 30.5 or 32. It can be as high as 36. But what I do want you to know is that under aerobic conditions, for every glucose, mitochondria can produce 30-something ATP, but under anaerobic conditions, glucose can only make 2 ATP because of glycolysis, right? All right, so that's really the take-home message. So what kind of condition would you like your cells to be in? Anaerobic or aerobic, and why? Aerobic, because you can just extract so much more energy out of glucose and produce many more ATP, right, with that one substrate level phosphorylation step in, Krebs cycle, and then all those ATP that can be made via the electron transport. All right, so here's just a table that shows where these high energy intermediates are produced. Right, we have what the first column is just substrate level phosphorylation. Right, that happens twice when glucose goes through glycolysis. That preparatory reaction doesn't produce any ATP when pyruvic acid binds to coenzyme A. That doesn't produce any ATP. But when a Krebs cycle makes one complete turn, it produces 1 ATP. And remember, for every glucose, Krebs cycle has to go around twice, so you get 2 ATP. And so add those together, direct level phosphorylation, 4 ATPs. And if we think about electron Well, if we think about these processes over here, which is what, glycolysis, the prep reaction, and Krebs cycle, this is just a tally of how many NADHs and FADHs are produced. Remember, Krebs cycle, can you see in your mind produce those three NADHs and it produced that one FADH2? Okay, and for the Krebs cycle, remember, it's got to go around two times, so that's why we have this two right here. That preparatory reaction, right, produces two NADHs. This should be NAD plus right here. Ooh, that's the first time I noticed that. It's NADH, sorry, times two, because the Krebs cycle goes around twice. And then glycolysis, remember, also produces some NADH. And you probably need to go back and look and see that it really does, but that was really in the summary equation for glycolysis. Maybe you could just memorize that one if you can't make a picture in your mind of glycolysis. But glycolysis produces two NADH. All right, but now let's consider one thing. Where are these two NADHs produced by glycolysis? What do you know about glycolysis? Go back to that very first slide that we were looking at. And I could zip back there. Okay, where are these two NADHs produced by glycolysis? Okay, I'll go back. Okay. Glycolysis. Oh, I got to go back a little bit further. Okay, glycolysis. Where is glycolysis taking place? In the cytoplasm. So these NADHs produced by glycolysis are in the cytoplasm, not inside the mitochondria. So in order for the electrons in those NADHs to be donated to electron transport chain, they have to get into the mitochondria, right? Because there's no electron transport chain in the cytoplasm. And when NADH is moved into the mitochondria, it loses some energy. The way they're transported, eventually they end up as an FADH molecule, not an NAD. And what can you tell me about the energy comparison between NADH and FADH2? Are they exactly the same? No, FADH is lower, produces 2 ATP. So it takes what? You could think of it takes 1 ATP just to get NADH inside the mitochondria because it's converted into FADH2. So those NADHs there, you have to count a little bit differently, and I'm sure this table shows that to you. Okay. NADHs produced by glycolysis in the cytoplasm, usually they enter the mitochondria as FADH2, which means that only 2 ATP can be made from the NADHs produced by glycolysis. So you have to adjust your equations a little bit. And then if you add these things together, you get about 30 ATP. Your book makes a little point of saying that under ideal conditions, right, you get 3 ATPs for every NADH, but under realistic conditions, it's somewhat less. Right. And same thing for FADH2. Your book makes a big point of saying that FADH2 only makes 1.5 ATPs. And NADH only makes 2.5 instead of what? What did we say? 3. All right, so I just want you to concentrate on FADH making 2 and NADH making 3. I'm not so concerned about these fractions right here. But under certain circumstances, things might change a little bit. And, of course, we're going to be talking about that for the next 100 years or so. And you have to take a test before 100 years is up. So we're just going to define. FAD makes 2, NADH makes 3. All right, so look through those. Maybe make a photocopy of glycolysis, photocopy of Krebs cycle, photocopy of electron transport. Lay it all out in front of you and just count the amount of ATPs by substrate level phosphorylation, how many NADHs are made, and then with the electron transport, then you'll be able to calculate how many ATPs are made when glucose is completely metabolized down to CO2 and water. So try to remember that water is the last thing that's being produced by aerobic respiration. All right, so let's go back to this very first slide that I said was so important. I should put a whole bunch of these in here, which is this right here. And so don't forget, here is that water that's being produced by aerobic respiration, and because aerobic respiration needs oxygen, Let's see what else about this. So I said the most important molecule is not on this slide. And did anybody kind of see what molecule was missing here? Is the point of glycolysis to make pyruvic acid? That's really not the point. Oh, well, maybe the point of glycolysis is to make lactic acid. Is that the point? No. All right, but under aerobic conditions, is the purpose of all of this right here to make CO2? No, it's not. Is it to make water? Because we need water in our body. Right, do we have respiration to make water? Is that the prime reason? And the answer is no. What is the most important reason why we have all these biochemical pathways? To make ATP, because going from glucose down to carbon dioxide is highly what? Exorganic, and your body can use that energy to make ATP. Okay? All right. So try to, this is going to be an extra credit drawing in lab. Maybe I've modified it a little bit, but I'll send that figure out to you. Question? Today? No, not today, because you don't have enough time to memorize something like that. Okay, it's going to take a little while to do that. Oh, will I send it today? No, because I'm way too busy today and tonight. I have to give a test tonight, and I have to grade it tonight. Okay, but soon. If you don't see it by Saturday, please send me an email, okay? Okay, I won't get my feelings hurt if you send me an email. Okay. All right, so that is the difference between aerobic respiration, anaerobic respiration, Krebs cycle, glycolysis, electron transport, and that chemiosmotic theory. The difference between direct phosphorylation or substrate level phosphorylation versus oxidative phosphorylation. Okay. All right, so I'm going to talk just a little bit about fat metabolism. You got some good questions at the end of the chapter and online. We won't have time to go into protein metabolism, but we're going to talk about fat metabolism just a little bit. Okay, so fats are a very important, very efficient way of storing energy inside our bodies. And what can you do with energy? What can you do with energy? You can perform work with it, right? So with that fat, you can perform work. So fats can be hydrolyzed to, well, a triglyceride can be hydrolyzed to glycerol and fatty acids. And then these fatty acids, just like glucose can be snipped apart to make CO2, these fatty acids can be broken down to make CO2. And that's a highly exorganic reaction, which then your body can use to make ATP. All right. And so some of the intermediates that are made from these fatty acids are acetyl groups. And what gets donated to the Krebs cycle? Those acetyl groups, right? So acetyl coenzyme A. And so that's why the statement right here says that some intermediates from fatty acids get run through the Krebs cycle. And indeed, that's the case because these acetyl groups enter the Krebs cycle. And once it's in the Krebs cycle, how many NADHs are produced? Do you have that picture in your mind yet? Three. Yeah, there's three. Okay. Proteins can be broken down into amino acids, and then that nitrogen group is removed with a deamination step. And then there are some carbon fragments that can be broken down into that acetyl group, and that can go through the Krebs cycle. So proteins can be used to make ATP. Fats can be used to make ATP. All right, so this statement is almost true. These pathways that we just talked about can be used to interconvert carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. Well, that's not exactly true. Okay, it is true that carbohydrates can be used to make proteins. Proteins sometimes can be used to make carbohydrates. It is true that carbohydrates can be used to make fats. Proteins can be used to make fats. But once something is a fat, it can never be anything else. Fats can't be used to make carbohydrates. Fats can't be used to make proteins. Right? Once something is a fat, it's a fat. As a matter of fact, any acetyl group, any two carbon fragment group, right, can only be metabolized to make CO2 or to be converted into fat. We talked about an interesting two carbon group last time when I drew out the fermentation reaction on the board. What in a fermentation, in a yeast fermentation process, what is produced? In our body, that fermentation produces lactic acid. But what does a yeast produce? It takes pyruvate, which is three carbons, and does what? Throws one away as CO2. And what's left over? There's a two-carbon molecule left over. And what did we say that two-carbon molecule was? Yeah, ethyl alcohol, right? Which is really toxic to us. So we don't produce that, but yeast really don't care. All right, so when you have that acetyl group. So when you drink alcohol, can it become a carbohydrate? Can it become a protein? Because it's an acetyl group, alcohol that we drink can only become a fat. So when you have a beer, forget about the carbohydrates, let's just consider the alcohol, or champagne, or wine, it's like eating what? It's like eating a bar of butter. Because that two-carbon fragment can only be used, I know, it's so disgusting. I won't be able to drink for a couple hours. Okay, because alcohol is a two-carbon fragment, and two-carbon fragments can only be joined together to make a fatty acid. Okay, so let's look at some things that are happening here. So here we have glycogen going to glucose. Ah, what do we call that? Glycogen to glucose. This will haunt you for the rest of your life. So we got to get this down so it's not so haunting. Glycogen to glucose is glycogenolysis, right? Glucose to glycogen is glycogenesis, right? So that's these two arrows right here. What's glucose going to pyruvate? That's glycolysis. Yeah, that's glycolysis. You're really familiar with glycolysis right now. What is pyruvate going back up to glucose? That is, gluconeogenesis, right? So these metabolic pathways can go one way or the other, and they go in the forward direction if your body needs ATP. They can go in the reverse direction when the energy state of your body is really, really high. All right, so here we see glucose, glycogen. All of these intermediates that we have in glycolysis are based on what kind of molecule? What kind of molecule is glucose? Break it down into one of the four major categories. Is it a protein? Is it a nucleic acid? A fat or a sugar? A sugar. Yeah, all of these intermediates are more like sugars, okay, than any other kind of molecule in your body. All right, so that is sugar. And over here we have fat. And let's just say this is a triglyceride. So you could consider triglyceride a fat or fat a triglyceride. You can use those terms interchangeably, I think, for right now. All right, so you have a fat or a triglyceride. What can it be broken down into? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? Or your body can take glycerol and fatty acids if there are plenty of these intermediates here, like acetyl-CoA, right? And then glycolysis can produce glycerol for you, and then your body just puts them all together to make a fat. What kind of reaction would be used to take three fatty acids and a glycerol and make a triglyceride out of it? Yeah, dehydration synthesis reaction. So you're kind of familiar with that already. All right, but the reaction that I really want to talk about is when fat is broken down the other way by a hydrolysis reaction. Right? And so this reaction, fat going back down to its building blocks, is what we call lipolysis, right? Breaking of lipids, lipolysis. So this dotted line right here, that's lipolysis. And what does lipolysis produce? And I want it just this bottom line right here. It produces fatty acids. And we said that there's a lot of energy stored in these fatty acids. These fatty acids then are broken down two carbons at a time, right? And it produces acetyl-CoA. Remember, an acetyl group has how many carbons in it? It's got two, right? So these fatty acids are just chopped down two carbons at a time until the fatty acid gets completely broken down. This step right here, fatty acids going to acetyl-CoA, that is not what we call lipolysis. This is what we call beta oxidation. All right, so you should be familiar with beta oxidation. That's the interconversion of fatty acids or the breakdown of fatty acids into acetyl-CoA. And then what can your body do with this acetyl-CoA? Donate it to the Krebs cycle, generate a lot of NADHs, which then you can generate a lot of ATPs with. But what did these fatty acids look like? Did they have just a few carbons, like maybe three, four, five carbons? It's a hydrocarbon chain. And is it a short chain? Or kind of a long chain, or a really long chain. It's a really long chain of these hydrocarbons, right? So For one fatty acid, you can produce many, many acetyl-CoAs, which can and each acetyl-CoA can produce many, many ATPs via oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, so we're going to take a look at beta oxidation in just a little bit. So here we have that acetyl-CoA. This slide is probably pretty good because we see with acetyl-CoA, what can your body do with it? Zip it over here, zip it over here. It can make a triglyceride out of it, right? So where is that? Fatty acids. Acetyl-CoA can make fatty acids like a triglyceride, and it can be modified, right, to be a phospholipid. Acetyl-CoA can also be used to synthesize cholesterol or maybe some other kind of steroid inside your body, like testosterone, estrogen. That's the basic building block molecule is cholesterol. And what kind of molecule is cholesterol? Is that a sugar, protein, lipid, or nucleic acid? Yeah, it's a lipid as well, right? So acetyl going to cholesterol is still just making a lipid. Right. Or acetyl-CoA can go into the mitochondria and can be converted into energy, right? It can be decarboxylated to produce CO2. And acetyl-CoA, under certain circumstances, if the Krebs cycle stops, we still can get some energy out of acetyl-CoA when it gets converted into what we call ketone bodies, like acetone and alpha-ketoglutarate. Now, I think what's important for you to see on the slide, that acetyl-CoA can be interconverted into other kinds of lipids. It can be metabolized to make ATP, right, or metabolized to make some ATP by the formation of ketone bodies. But this acetyl group can never be used to make what? What's missing from this slide right here? Sugar. It can never be used to make sugar. And what did we say about this step right here? What are all these molecules? These are basically sugar intermediates. Right? And the intermediates in the Krebs cycle are based on sugar molecules. All right, so acetyl-CoA can't help build up the intermediates with the Krebs cycle either. So what do you have to have in your diet in order for this Krebs cycle to keep working? You need some low level of sugar in your diet. That's all there's to it, right? And so when you starve yourself from sugar, that stops the Krebs cycle from operating, and it stops then what? The electron transport chain, because it's not producing any DH. And that's kind of the basis of some diets, which are maybe not so much in vogue, but anybody remember there was one diet, there was a fad where you could restrict your diet of one kind of chemical and you'd lose a tremendous amount of weight. Like the Atkins diet, yeah, it seems really marvelous. Atkins diet, you don't eat any sugar molecules, no sugar, at least maybe for the first couple of weeks or so, which means what? The Krebs cycle would stop operating, and if the Krebs cycle stops operating, then your body doesn't know what to do with all of this acetyl-CoA. Remember, here's sugar going through glycolysis, so glycolysis isn't happening either. So your body goes to fat to try to get some energy out of fat, makes fatty acids. So fat to fatty acids is lipolysis, fatty acids to acetyl-CoA is beta oxidation. But now with these acetyl-CoAs, they can't get into Krebs cycle because there's no sugars in your body. So what happens to these acetyl-CoAs? Yeah, they get converted into ketone bodies like acetone, and we mentioned that before. Acetone is the ingredient in fingernail polish remover. So if you pour some fingernail polish remover on a table, what will happen to it? Will it sit there for until next week when we come back? No, it will evaporate very, very quickly. It's highly volatile. And certain people like diabetics that are producing a lot of ketone bodies, you can actually smell that on their breath. Okay, acetone and other kinds of ketones. So when somebody's on an Atkins diet, they're only producing acetyl-CoA. Can't go over here to the citric acid cycle. And your body produces these ketones, which are highly volatile, what do you do with those ketones? If you can smell it on somebody's breath, where are they going? From inside your body to, you're just breathing it out. And that's really kind of fascinating with the Atkins diet. You don't have to exercise, you can just breathe lipid out of your body, right? By what? By shutting down the Krebs cycle. But what's the side effect when the Krebs cycle can't work? Okay, and if the Krebs cycle is not working, then electron transport chain isn't working. So what's the side effect of an Atkins diet? What was the most important molecule on that one, that very first slide? ATP. Yeah, so somebody is not making ATP very efficiently when you're on the Atkins diet. And your brain uses, well, you know so much ATP, it uses glucose a lot to make ATP, but you don't have that glucose in your body. So people on Atkins diet can get really dingy as a result of that because there's just not enough ATP in the brain. You might start driving on the opposite side of a road. You might not be able to appreciate the change in a light signal at an intersection. Right? So it's really kind of a serious condition. Okay, the other thing that you might notice is that it produces ketone bodies, and that's the same thing that a diabetic will produce. So when somebody's on an Atkins diet, it's like inducing a diabetes-like condition in somebody's body. Because diabetes means what? Sugars can't enter cells. And when you don't eat glucose, there's no glucose to enter the cells. Atkins diet is like forcing your body into a diabetic condition. Diabetics produce ketone bodies. Atkins diet produces ketone bodies. The benefit is you can just breathe lipids out of your body. The trade-off is you can't make a lot of ATP. So don't be on an Atkins diet when you're taking microbiology, okay, or anatomy, or probably even physiology, because you just won't be able to appreciate what's going on in class. Is anybody on an Atkins diet right now? Back there? Nobody? I don't see anybody raising their hand. You might not be able to raise your hand even if you're on an Atkins diet. So I don't know if that means anything or not. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting illustration in your book, but we got to talk about beta oxidation. When you metabolize a sugar, you get about 4 kilocalories, that's a unit of energy, for every gram of sugar. And pretty much the same for protein, it's about 4. So proteins and sugars can be metabolized, and what it does, it produces about 4 kilocalories. What about a fat? It can produce 9 kilocalories, more than double the amount of energy in a fat compared to sugar or protein. So if you want to restrict calories from your diet, what would you want to restrict? Sugars, proteins, or lipids? Lipids, because they're so caloric. They have so much caloric, so much energy for the same kind of weight. Oh, here it says 4 grams. Good. Okay. So storage of triglycerides is very efficient. What's the first step in metabolizing a lipid? Is, I think you wrote that down on your slide, going from a lipid to fatty acid, right? Breaking down a triglyceride to a fatty acid. What did we call that? What do we call that? What do we call this step right here? Lipolysis. Yeah, so the first step is lipolysis. Oh, that's exactly what we got right here. Lipolysis, the breakdown of fat into fatty acids and glycerol. That's the building block of a triglyceride. Via what kind of reaction? Hydrolysis reaction. You know that. Didn't have to tell you that. And the enzyme that breaks lipids down is lipase. Okay? And so that's what we call lipolysis. And the second step right here, taking a fatty acid. So lipolysis is what? The production of fatty acids. Then fatty acids can be used to make acetyl-CoAs. Fatty acids can be broken down 2 carbons at a time. And then those acetyl-CoAs can be run through the Krebs cycle. So taking a fatty acid to acetyl-CoA, I think I need to write this on the board. All right, so triglyceride to, I'm just going to abbreviate that, fatty acid. All right, so triglyceride to fatty acid. What am I not putting here? What am I just kind of ignoring? What do you need to make a triglyceride? Fatty acids and glycerol. So I'm going to ignore glycerol. I just want to consider these fatty acids. What kind of reaction is this? A lipase enzyme is needed. It's called lipolysis. That's lipolysis. And then fatty acid, remember, is just a big, huge, long hydrocarbon chain. I'm not using the same. Here we go. Fatty acid. fatty acid being broken down into acetyl CoA. Little O, big A, acetyl CoA. And remember, that's two carbons, like that. So what do we call this process? We don't want to call that lipolysis, because lipolysis is breaking down a triglyceride. This is what we call beta oxidation. And that happens inside a mitochondria as well, beta oxidation, producing all those acetyl CoAs. So let's take a look at, Well, we store lipids, triglycerides, in adipose tissue. So lipase has to be in adipose tissue, to break triglyceride down. Mitochondria probably have some lipases. Blood probably has some lipases in it as well. But the majority would be in an adipose site, okay? And then fatty acids are shipped around in your body, okay, to various organs that can metabolize it down to acetyl-CoA. All right, so here is, let's look at this really quick. This is beta oxidation. And again, what does beta oxidation do? It breaks down fatty acids into acetyl-CoA. And you know what you can do with acetyl-CoA. Beta oxidation clips acetyl groups off of the fatty acid. And here is a fatty acid. Right here, here's that acid group on the end of that big long hydrocarbon chain. Right, so it's going to be carbon-carbon, and then what? Carbon-carbon, and carbon-carbon, and that will go for, you could have 15, 20, 25 hydrocarbons in a line right here. That would be a fatty acid. So how does that happen? Well, sort of like glycolysis, it takes some energy to get this going. Right? So to break off this first two-carbon fragment, an ATP is used up. But it adds that coenzyme A to this last carbon. Right? So ATP is used up. Now we have coenzyme A bound to the fatty acid. And then there's some rearrangements of these single and double bonds. So where you get down over here, you still have the fatty acid, the modified fatty acid bound to coenzyme A. This interconversion produces some FADH2. And if this is inside the mitochondria, so how many ATPs can be made by just this interconversion here, part of the first step of beta oxidation? What did we say? Yeah, two ATPs can be made. Right. And then some water can be added. Oh, what do you need water for? Like a hydrolysis type of reaction? All right, so there's just some rearrangements right here. It produces a fatty acid in this configuration. And then finally, over here, we have another oxidation reduction reaction that produces NADH, right? It takes NAD+, converts it into NADH, and you should know NADH produces 3 ATP. Right? And then finally, these two carbons will be cleaved off of that fatty acid. So now the fatty acid is two carbons shorter compared to how it was at the very beginning. And then that acetyl-CoA can go into the Krebs cycle, and that produces 10 ATP. So beta oxidation is the breakdown of what, a triglyceride? I have it right here. What's it breaking down? Beta oxidation is breaking down, fatty acids, right? And in so doing, it generates some high energy electrons. And what can your body do with high energy electrons? Make gobs of ATP out of it, right? Okay. All right, so that's the beauty of beta oxidation. It can produce a tremendous amount of ATP. Okay, and I guess I can say one last thing. These triglycerides, let's go back to here. These triglycerides or fat, will these things dissolve in water? Do they dissolve in water? They don't, because they're lipids, right? So when you store fat in your body, it's also very efficient because you can't store water with it. So when you have a store of energy as a lipid, it's just pure lipid. If you store energy in the form of carbohydrate, how does your body store energy in the form of a carbohydrate? What's the form of that? Glycogen, right? Glycogen is a storage form of energy in a sugar molecule, right? And when you store glycogen, you need to package it with water. It has to dissolve in water. And we don't really use water as an energy source. So storing energy as sugar is very inefficient because it has to be packaged with water. And fat is what? Basically just pure fat. And that's even beside the fact that a sugar will produce 4 kilocalories per gram, and a lipid, a fat, will produce 9 kilocalories per gram. So again, that just kind of illustrates what a perfect form fat is for storing energy in our bodies. Okay, so that's all I'm going to talk about. Study over the weekend. Write some questions down when you come back to lecture, so because I'm sure you're going to have some questions on this stuff. Sign-in sheet is going around. Yeah? Yep. Yeah. But you know what? That acetyl-CoA from a fatty acid means that the Krebs cycle only goes around one time. So your question is really good. Why is it 10 ATP? Let's see if we can figure this out. So one turn of the Krebs cycle does what? Yeah, 3 NADH, 3 NADH, 1 FADH2, Krebs cycle, oh, and then 1 ATP as well. Okay. So how many ATPs altogether? Well, for NADH, we're going to say 3. All right, so we're going to say 3 ATP, and for FADH2, 2 ATP. But, so we got to multiply this by 1. We got to multiply this by 3. And then let's just bring ATP over to here. ATP. All right, so what is that? We got 9. All right, 2 times 1 is 2. And then 1 over here. All right, so that's 13. Your book has a 10. Why is that? Because your book likes to think of NADH as being what? Not really 3, but 2.5. FADH, really, your book says, is 1.5. I don't really care about that. But if you use 2.5 here instead of the 3, okay, that 3 right there, then you get 10. That's how you get it. Yeah. So it's a little strange.
I emailed you, and I just realized it bounced back to me. But
I didn't see it.
Yeah, so did you. Okay. I talked to Professor Vora, and he said that they would move me to switch into the lab, and he said it's okay for you to email him.
Probably not. Yeah, because there's no good way to transfer grades in Blackboard. So that's just a big problem of bookkeeping.
So there's no way at all?
Yeah. Because the grade books would get all mixed up. It'd be really hard. It would be almost impossible to keep track of your grades. Yeah, and I would have to kind of do the same, and it would just be too messy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sign-in sheet. Hi.
I just had my grade in the grade book.
Ooh.
Should I worry?
We have to find your...
I checked with you. I don't know if you remember. I came to your...
And we found it?
We found it.
Oh, well, that's too bad I didn't put it in.
Okay.
No, you don't have to worry.
Okay,
but
fine.
Probably you should send me an email.
I would.
And I can only do that when I'm on campus, because that's when I have... That's probably what happened. Do you have a piece of paper?
Right,
you could, yeah, just write it on a piece of paper. Even...
Oh, I can email you.
Yeah, but you know what? If I have a piece of paper in my hand, I won't put it down until I change your grade. And I would like that. Just put it here. Put your lab, and if you know the CRN number, that would be really good. Okay. Put your lab, your name, and then just say enter grade, please. good day for me to do that.